Welcome to Talking About California. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm hosting a new KZYX series. I'm also the director of the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit research and education center on the coast. In this series, we're talking to Californians about California, and I hope we're considering issues of importance and interest to listeners here on California's North Coast. Today, our guest is Professor David Goldberg. David Goldberg is professor of comparative literature in the School of Humanities at the University of California, Irvine. He is director of the University of California Humanities Research Institute, and he was formerly director and professor of the School of Justice Studies at Arizona State University. Professor Goldberg writes about race. He is author of Racist Culture, Philosophy and the Politics of Meaning and Racial Subjects, another book, Writing on Race in America. His latest book is The Racial State. Good morning and welcome, David.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, I think we'll be talking about race this morning, race in California. So, let's get right to it. First, David, let me start with this. I think it's not really such a simple subject. So, maybe if we could start off with just something very general. What is race?
Yeah, so that's a question that's more complex than one thinks. There's been a long history dating to about the 1450s of race both having meaning and changing its meaning over time. Since about the 1850s, I mean, after Darwin came along and wrote The Origin of the Species, race come to mean subspecies, that is, subcategories of species formation in relation to small groupings and most notably human groupings. So if species are largely geographic populations that the members of which are capable of interbreeding with each other, but not with members for the most part of other species, then subspecies are those who are more specifically geographically located or taken to be geographically located. And have common, so the story goes, common phenotypical characteristics, like in human cases, skin color, certain kinds of facial characterizations, and so on and so forth, and are capable of breeding across subspecies groupings. So that's the more modern conception of the term. It started out early on as kinship relation, right? So race would be those members of a common kinship group, morphed into this more general sort of conception of subspecies grouping. Now, you know, the general that race has race indicates that while it's supposed to be members of a given racial group are supposed to be those who have common phenotypical characteristics or common physical characteristics or behavioral characteristics and so on, for almost any member of a supposed racial group, those characteristics can be more like non-members of the group than they are members of the group. So race itself, critically, is shown to be somewhat empty-minded. I mean, it's really a social category rather than a biological or physical category of any delineated sort.
Could you just go back to that word social category for a minute, if listeners are not familiar with what you're saying there?
Right. So, you know, the way in which race historically has been formulated, particularly coming out of the 19th century, is that it was supposed to have scientific status, according to the delineation of these kinds of characteristics. So a skin color of a certain kind, or certain behavioral characteristics, certain mental capacities, intellectual capacities, and so on and so forth, which were supposed to be measurable. So, I mean, coming out of the late 18th and into the 19th centuries, there was a period in which skull size was measured, for example, and it was measured by filling emptied skulls with lead shot and then weighing them, and obviously the heavier the weight was taken to be, the larger the brain capacity was supposed to be indicated. Now, that's a very loose way of measuring intellectual capacity, to say the least, right? I mean, there's not great correlation between brain size and intellectual capacity. So this has morphed into a indication, really, an understanding on the part, particularly in critical literature, that race is not really a biological or a scientific category at all, that any claim to racial differentiation has invested in it some kind of social implications, values that are invested and embedded and presumed in the supposed scientific indication. So just take skin color, for example. I mean, if one wants to differentiate on the basis of skin color, you think, okay, there's a color coding. One can go from darker, say, black to white. But, black people are not per se black for the most part. And the shadings of brown and honey color and so on and so forth. And white people, I mean, there's a famous saying at the trial of Steve Biko, one of the trials of Steve Biko in South Africa, the famous black consciousness intellectual and activist in the 1970s. The then apartheid prosecutor said, "Mr. Biko, why do you call yourself black? You're not black, you're brown." To which Biko shot back very cleverly and smartly, "Mr. Prosecutor, you're not white, you're pink," right? And that indicates the way in which you get social values invested and embedded in these putative or supposed claims to biological classification.
So let me ask one more very general question then to get us started, and another one without an easy answer, I suspect. And I should say, of course, I'm not interested in political correctness here, but if that's the case, what language do we use to talk about race, if in that sense it doesn't exist? What words?
I'm not saying it doesn't exist.
Yeah, okay, well, let's...
One wants to be a bit more careful. I mean, it exists, but it exists as a social category. It doesn't, it has been shown repeatedly that whatever racial spectrum you take, on the basis of supposed objective classifications or criteria, that members within a supposed racial group have closer affinity on those criteria, often to members outside of that supposed racial group than they have to members within the racial group, right? So that's on the the so-called biological classification. To say that race is a social classification is not to say that it's no classification at all. It's embedded with loose, pragmatic, perceptual, visual implications and so on, which if taken with a grain of salt, you can say, and is tied not simply to physical conditions, but also to a range in particular of cultural expression and so on and so forth. So, when you put all that together, it becomes a much more complex set of configurations and characterizations that within a given society, I mean, those within America who are classified as black because of the history of the so-called one-drop rule, you know, dating back to the late 19th and into the 20th centuries, those classified as black might not be classified as black in a different society, like in Latin America, for example, or even under apartheid South Africa, when there was at least a threefold and more likely a fourfold distinction between racial classification groups, black, white, mixed race, colored in the case of South Africa, and those of Asian descent in the case of South Africa. In the U.S., you know, given the history, particularly in the South, of the one-drop rule, those who today might be characterized as having been or having been of mixed race, you know, being 1/8 black or whatever, you know, even those characterizations are somewhat pernicious. Those mixed race groups, you know, not so long ago, I mean, not even 30 years ago, would have been characterized as black and not as mixed race.
Right. So let's turn to California now and see if we can start a discussion of that. And I was sort of thinking, if the U.S. is in any sense a melting pot, that old term, then what on earth must California be? A state of immigrants, of what? A constantly changing sort of place. Could you tell us a little bit about California in terms of race, ethnicity, migration?
Yeah, sure. I mean, California, of course, is a long-standing mix of population groups coming into interaction with each other through in and out migration, mainly in migration, and of course mixing with the local indigenous population going back you know, a much longer time. So the population has grown and changed dramatically, not least in the last 30 years. So if you just think of, you know, maybe we can think backwards from where we are today. The population of California today, 2012, is approaching 38 million people. You know, it has grown, if you look at the census data from 2000 to 2010, it grew 10% in that period, so it went from, you know, roughly 33 million to 36 million in that period. So it's growing, you know, between, I'd say, somewhere between 10 and 15% every decade. The decade before, 1990 to 2000, it grew by about 13%. So we're, you know, we're fairly rapidly approaching 40 million people in total. But the population has become increasingly mixed and is the most mixed of any demographic among states in the United States. So of that almost 38 million, 40%, just a little over 40%, not quite 40%, is of those who in census terms would be regarded as white but not Hispanic, so non-Hispanic whites. If you add those who characterize themselves as both Hispanic in the census terms and white, that percentage jumps a bit above 60%. So the white population overall, you know, including both subcategories, would be a bit over 60%. But if you take the, you know, what is sometimes characterized as the Anglo-white population, that would be 40%. Latinos, you know, white and people of color are almost 35%, about 33%, I think, is the number today. And growing fairly rapidly, although the rate of increase is slowing down a bit than it was, say, a decade or two decades ago. the black African heritage or African American population has decreased a bit. It's now just a little over 6%, down from about 7% a decade and a half ago. Interestingly enough, one can differentiate. I mean, California is a somewhat younger population in some ways than maybe the average across the United States. I mean, if the characterization of the population across the U.S. is of a somewhat aging population, it's less so in California, largely, I think, as a result of both the Latino population and to some extent the Asian American population. The population of Asian descent is double that of blacks, 13%, and increasing at a somewhat faster rate as a result of immigration. There are almost 200 languages spoken across California. I think it's about 30+% speak a language other than English as a first language in the home, largely but not only Spanish and one of the Asian languages. It's a very, very, very varied population. It's been varied, for a good long time, but the variation has increased fairly dramatically over the past couple of decades, largely as a result of immigration and the larger population growth among those incoming than those who are here. The rate of population growth tends to slow down for second, third generation Californians than it than is the case for first generation Californians, interestingly enough. It's a very, as I said, very, very, very population. It's a population that has plurality rather than any single majority, and that increasingly is the case. So that, this demographic heterogeneity and cultural heterogeneity to some extent and on some indices will only increase.
I wonder, does it make any sense when considering that diversity to think in terms of hierarchy?
Well, it depends what one means by hierarchy. I mean, certainly politically, until very recently, you could say that the political power structures in the state and the, for the most part, the economic power structure has been dominated by those of those who are white. That has, begun to erode to some degree. And varies, depending where you are. I mean, there's now a Latino mayor of LA, and of course there was a longstanding black mayor of LA. It probably varies by site and particularly by city in the state. The population of California is largely located within cities. I mean, and in that sense, it's a quintessentially modern or late modern society. LA and the LA Basin and extension all the way down into Orange County, of course, and up maybe, sort of as far north as Santa Barbara, sort of Ventura and Oxnard and so on, is where the major state population is located. But then you've got, these large satellite areas, in particular the San Francisco Bay Area in the north and San Diego in the south, and then, also Sacramento and Fresno and so on as sort of smaller satellites. Yeah, and given the demographic differences across those urban settings, you know, power politically and economically is differentiated, you could say ethno-racially, in some ways. You know, power, I think, is still arguably vested overwhelmingly, both economically and politically, the two go together, and educationally, I would argue as well, particularly in higher education, is you know, vested largely in the hands of those who are white, and the, you know, the poorer segments of the population tend to be clustered overwhelmingly among people of color, in particular blacks and increasingly Latinos, out of proportion, significantly out of proportion to the numbers in the population. So that, you know, the prison population overwhelmingly is made up of people of color. It's about 77%, I think, in total in California. You know, out of a population that doesn't even closely approach that. So that, you know, you see that the disproportions there, and if one means by hierarchy something like those power disproportions, then I would say yes, it's significantly hierarchical. And you know, interestingly enough, the demography in higher education, while transforming and has transformed over the past two decades, has transformed in ways not consistent with the, not altogether consistent with the proportions in the population more generally. So, yeah, and it depends, particularly in public universities. So thinking of the UC system and the Cal State system in particular, if you look at the population distributions and the demography of students in particular there, depending on campus, you know, it's approaching, you know, it's around 40%, Berkeley, UCLA, Irvine, San Diego, of Asian American students, and they're only 13% in the population, right? Yeah. And, you know, whites are probably another 35%, something like that. So, or more, 40%, sort of close. So, you know, the overwhelming student, undergraduate student bodies in particular are made up of Asians and whites, and, you know, much fewer, representatives of other folks. You know, Riverside might be a bit different. The Cal State system, you know, probably a bit more even.
David, I wondered if we could just come back to that in a minute, because I know you wanted to talk about that and we wanted to hear about that. I did want to tell the listeners, though, that this is KZYX radio. The program is talking about California, and I'm the host, Cal Winslow. Today, our guest is David Goldberg. David Goldberg is a professor of literature at the University of California in Irvine. He's the author of many important books, including his latest, which is The Racial Nation, I think it's called. David, before we really get into education, I wanted to ask you one more historic question. Could I do that?
Sure.
Just thinking about my own interest in these questions, historically, it's kind of seemed to me that in the U.S., we've tended to think in black and white terms, maybe along the lines of Du Bois's idea about the color line. That's a black and white world. And in terms of what you're saying about California, you know, has that changed then? Is that really a way of thinking which has been, which belongs in the past? Because I can't help thinking, you know, now we have this Florida case of Trayvon Wilson, the Florida youngster who was murdered, and these things seem to go on and on. I wondered if you could give us some guidance on that sort of bigger historical picture and why there do seem to be elements of this black-white divide that continue or persist.
Right, sure. So, I mean, one needs to think historically in these terms, right? And, you know, if one shifts the sort of image from Florida to California, it's interesting to note, I mean, the African-American in-migration into the state, while, you know, has existed for a good long while. I mean, it got a big boost as a result of the sort of Oklahoma Dust Bowl migration in the 1930s and sort of post-depression or mid-depression kind of immigration, where, you know, the migration out of the South by African Americans after the ending of slavery sort of also went west. You know, so the reason Tulsa has had a significant African American population in Oklahoma was as a result of that west migration, sort of in the wake of postbellum Civil War America, and then that population kept on going west as conditions deteriorated, one might say, in the Midwest. It's interesting that in urban environments like Los Angeles, what is not especially well known, although it's become a bit better known more recently, is that there was quite significant legally mandated segregation in the city center, particularly in the 1940s. That was contested. You know, blacks were, African Americans were more or less restricted to South Central, the kind of Crenshaw district. So you think of Hollywood movies that sort of represent that. So Devil in a Blue Dress would be a good representation of the kind of segregated sort of life, particularly residentially, that LA experienced in the 1940s and into the 1950s, and then got eroded sort of over time with the civil rights movements and so on. And you think of the way in which African Americans arrived in Oakland, for example. And so, you know, all through the 1960s and into the 1970s, and probably tapering off into the 1980s, precisely because demography began to change, the dominant or the change became more visible, let's say, in the 1980s rather than began to change. The dominant image of race in California probably mirrored the dominant image nationally, and that is Du Bois. I mean, the black-white divide, right? And that began to be eroded both nationally and very dramatically in California, from roughly 1980 onwards, where you had significant immigration of Latinos in much larger numbers than hitherto. The numbers began to change proportionately, very visibly, which is not to say the numbers weren't there before. It just became much much deeper and more visible. And at that point, the heterogeneity of California began to sort of jump out at one. Not just tensions between Latinos and blacks. I mean, we're all aware of that in various ways, kind of population group self-interest kind of emerging, the kind of securing of, territory would not be too harsh a way to put it, even as there were, obviously attempts and undertakings to overlay that with interaction, in schools, in residential areas, and so on. I mean, America historically, residentially, is extremely segregated, and the patterns of segregation changed over time. So, if at the end of the Civil War, the pattern of segregation was largely rural black, urban white across America. Post-Civil War, that changed to neighborhood segregation as you had migration, particularly of black folk into northern cities, and northern and Midwestern and Western cities. That shifted from rural urban to intra-urban neighborhood segregation in the 1930s and 1940s, including California, most notably, so Crenshaw on the west side, for example. And then re-emerged in the 1980s, a long shift from the 1950s through the 1980s became visible in the 1980s of segregation becoming not simply neighborhood segregation, but urban segregation. What I mean by that, and what other researchers have meant by that, is that those who are taken to belong to different racial groupings, blacks, Latinos, whites in particular, and you might say to some degree in California also Asians, literally live in different cities, have come to live in different cities. That's eroded somewhat in the last decade or so, but from the 1980s until, into the 2000s, increasingly, because of suburbanization and then suburbs turning into their own sort of municipal areas, blacks, whites, Latinos literally came to live in different cities. So in Southern California, Santa Ana would be a case of, where Latinos largely lived. In the Orange County area, whereas, and Cambodians would live in Los Angeles and not Los Angeles, sorry, Long Beach, and so on. You can see how this sort of factors out. So, to come back more directly to your question, has segregation and particularly racial formation shifted in California? The answer is absolutely yes. And so it's been overlaid, particularly in California, the rapid increase in the Latino population. And the decrease proportionately in the black population of California. And as a consequence, the kinds of issues that have emerged most visibly as politically driven issues around race would be, of course, immigration, which in relation to African Americans was much less pressing.
So I guess connected to that, historically, again, we sometimes, can think of in our history of a series of crusades. I remember some, it's a funny word, crusades, but I remember, a professor of mine wrote a book, A Crusade Against Slavery. And then in the 50s and 60s,
unfortunate title.
Yeah, in the 50s and 60s, a crusade against segregation and Jim Crow in the South. But if we forget that word for the minute, then we think, though, of the what was I think implied, and that was the idea of a great moral issue and a moral crisis. Can we do we think in those terms at all about what we're calling, a different kind, but a segregation in California? Is it a moral issue? Is this an area?
Well, I think I think it obviously has moral dimensions, but I think we should not simply reduce it to a moral issue, because in the sort of public imagination, moral issues tend to be those things that become sort of simply or only personal. So I have to make a choice for myself whether I'm going to, push back against segregation, or whether I'm going to take a stand about the Trevion Wilson case, or cases like it that one finds in California, for example. I mean, California, just to give you a sense of how different it is from some, at least, other parts of the country. I mean, there was a statistic last week where 21% of those in Mississippi still believe that interracial marriage should be illegal, and 29% aren't sure whether it should be legal or not. So that roughly 50% of the population of Mississippi have an issue with interracial marriage, right? That absolutely is not the case in California for the most part. I mean, particularly in urban California. So it might be a personal moral issue for this or that individual, but as a kind of social commitment in the state, one feels fairly at ease. I'm in an interracial relationship and have been for, well over a decade, and one feels completely at ease here in a way in which one might not feel in Mississippi, for example. And so that the, I would call it a political issue first and foremost, rather than a moral issue, a deeply social issue that the society, in this case, the society that is the state of California, needs to be committed to and needs to face down. And it takes many dimensions which are interconnected deeply and interactive with each other. So when one thinks about racial matters, one needs to think about the relation between residential areas. And because residential areas are so deeply connected to where kids get schooled, to schooling, education, and by extension then to higher education, and by extension, because both those things matter so deeply, also to employment opportunities. Those three factors, residence, education, employment, which after, and by extension, you could say health, provision or access, and so on, the kind of, the social goods available in the society are deeply connected to these things. And so in thinking about, and that's why I say it's a political and social issue, not merely a moral issue. If we're really deeply committed to desegregation, not now simply non-segregation, but really to a desegregated society, on every register, one has to be thinking about the interactive engagement of those factors. So one has to be thinking about the way in which neighborhoods become desegregated. I mean, just to think about the Trevion case, right, in Sanford, Florida, one has to think that a young black kid, a 17-year-old black kid, is being followed by a white, ultimately a white vigilante, right, in that neighborhood, is precisely because the neighborhood, for the most part, is segregated, right? It considers itself to be a white neighborhood. If, in a neighborhood that is demographically mixed and residentially mixed in vigorous ways, it's much less likely to happen precisely because people more readily feel at ease with each other in those circumstances. I mean, you could put it slightly differently. You could ask yourself why it is that, and this then does speak to the heart of California, why it is that cities in America that have robust public transport systems, metros, trains, undergrounds, and so on. So you think of New York, Chicago, Boston, San Francisco, also cities with progressive political climates for the most part, not to overplay it, whereas those environments that are much more automobile driven, those urban environments that are much more automobile driven, where people are getting in the cars pretty much on their own and driving to work, in cities across the Southwest, San Diego, arguably LA, and so on and so forth, tend to be much more segregated environments, urban environments. And I think there's a deep connection between those things.
Just let me remind listeners one more time. This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. We're talking about California, and today we're speaking to Professor David Goldberg of the University of California at Irvine, who's the author of many books, and today is talking to us or leading a discussion on the subject of race in California. Now, David, I know I interrupted you a few minutes ago when you were talking about education, and I want to return to that, and we need to talk about it. So you had talked a bit about the diversity within higher education, I think, when I cut you off. Let's go back to that, but let me ask you in case we don't get time, to think about two other questions before we're finished. And one would be the issue of racism. We talked about race at the very beginning of the program, and maybe we could talk about what racism is, because I know it seems to me in terms of higher education, there's been a consistent discussion of racism in higher education and racism in our culture. So you might keep that in mind when you're telling us about the situation in higher education today. And also, I wanted to ask you about the concept of racelessness, or sometimes we hear about a post-racial society sort of in the era of Obama. But let's start with education, and maybe we'll think about those terms as we go along. But you're very much involved in higher education in the state of California, especially in the UC system. So maybe you could tell us a bit about your own work and then about your thoughts about what's happening in that area to us and in education in general.
Right. So I run a research institute that serves all 10 campuses of the University of California, and the mission of which is to bring faculty and graduate students across the 10 universities into research engagements with each other in collaborative ways. And so I have a somewhat unique position, certainly as a faculty person, being able to see across 10 universities, almost all of which are major research institutions in the country, in a public university system, which is probably the most important public university system in the United States, if not in the world. As a system, there's almost literally nothing like it. So the work we do is deeply connected to thinking about the future of education and access and what education might and should look like, sort of looking forward under what have been very trying circumstances when, as a result of the budget cuts, the University of California has lost very, very significant public funding. When I arrived at the University of California over a decade ago in 2000, there was roughly 27% of $15 billion of the annual budget. The annual budget of the University of California was then something like $15 billion. 27% of that came from the state of California. And the rest came in fees and federal funding and private gifts and so on and so forth. 2 years ago, that proportion was about 13% of a $19 billion budget. So it had been cut in half almost, literally, in a decade. And, you know, with the $750 million cut to the University of California budget, you know, it's closer to 10% today of a $19 billion budget. The $750 million was a cut not to the $19 billion overall, it was a cut to the $3.5 billion that the state provided a year ago, right? So it very, very, very significant cuts, which impacts, you know, what the university system can then do for the population of California. So a couple of things have happened. I mean, the first, you know, roughly a third of the adult population of California has higher education, has a college degree, right? I think everybody realizes that the better educated a population, you know, the better off the population across the state will be. Earning power tends to be greater. You know, the quality of life in the state tends to be better. The quality of civic discussion and so on and so forth. So it has significant impact across the state. You know, unfortunately, the racial demography has not been great going back at least to the 1990s. You remember that the proposition that ended affirmative action had a fairly dramatic impact, particularly on Black and Latino access by students to the university. The shift was interesting because it wasn't just that Blacks and Latinos didn't get into the university. It was that they were then siloed to those campuses that were regarded as academically less significant within the system. So arguably, there's some argument here, but arguably the kind of education to which they had access was not as good as, say, the kind of education and the prospects that would come out of that education for employment opportunities and so on were not as good as those for white, in particular white students and students of Asian background. To link that to the question about racism, I think, is not uninteresting. I mean, racism is really the exclusion from opportunities and possibilities, inclusion and inclusion that are a function of racial membership, that are racially driven and racially based, right? So that if one is being excluded from opportunities, both historically and contemporarily, in ways that are factored into what racial group one belongs to, you know, that begins to raise the question of whether racism is at play. Now, I know you're going to be talking to Ruthie Gilmore about prisons, but Ruthie Gilmore, and so it would be interesting to link this to her conversation. People have pointed out that access to education, particularly higher education, is in some ways inversely proportional to the likelihood of people ending in prison, right? And, about a decade ago, all of a sudden more was being spent on prisons than was being spent on education, particularly higher education, in the state. So that was a significant shift. But Ruthie points out that that a key aspect of the, you could say, the impact of racism in a society is the impact on overall well-being and therefore the greater likelihood of death as a result of being subjected to racism. Death as a result of violent intervention, being shot by a vigilante, for example, would be one instance, but, you know, police harassment or police intervention or, being consigned or delimited to neighborhoods that are more violent. So those aspects, but also death, premature death, as a result of you know, increase health elements in one's life. So the fact that one is more subjected to stress is more likely to lead one to live a less healthful life and therefore to die earlier or sooner than one might have had one not been subjected to those kinds of racially driven stresses. So you can see the way in which education, access to higher education, a better well-being, better lifestyle, access to healthcare as a better healthcare as a consequence, then factor also into one's life prospects over time and one's family life prospects over time. What is very interesting is that in the last 20 years, 25 years, the differential in black and Latino to white family wealth, right? In other words, the kinds of resources a family has available to it has increased. Those differentials have increased. They've gone from roughly 12 to 1 25 years ago, you know, a white to black and white to Latino, to 18 to 1 in the case of white to Latino,
you
and
said,
20 to 1.
David, you said 12 to 1, that's the what you said?
That, yeah, 12,
12
to 1.
Times?
12 times. 12 times the wealth, the family wealth differential 25 years ago. It's now 18 times for Latinos and 20 times for blacks. Very significant.
Staggering.
Yeah, it is staggering. And those are national figures. And I haven't seen the comparable figures for California, but I'd warrant that those figures in California are at least comparable over time. And, you know, so the prospects for well-being across a life and across a family life become very, very significant. And so that relation to premature death, I think, is a deep insight, you know, that links life prospects, education, general well-being to how one lives one's life, and is connected very deeply to the question of segregation we were discussing earlier.
And so maybe in the time we have left, return a bit to the idea of affirmative action, or you know, what the conservatives today seem to so deeply despise. The what do they call it, social engineering or whatever? Is there in terms of affirmative steps, actions, is there something that you might want to raise as far as education and higher education in particular is concerned? Are there responsibilities?
It's a very good question. I think there are two kinds of response. The one is that, you know, as we know, affirmative action, once again, is deeply under attack. It's significant that it has been under attack, particularly in those states, not only that are demographically mixed, but where the student population on a campus approaches 20%, those who, in particular who are of a black and Latino demographic background, right? So as it approaches 20% of the student body, the pushback against affirmative action seems to get louder and louder. So Michigan, Texas, New York, California are the most significant states that you can identify sort of as you go around the kind of borderlands of the country, so to speak. You know, it's important, I think, to recognize that access to higher education at a time when, you know, the public support, financial support for higher education has come under increasing duress, that the sort of racially heterogeneous mix of the student body population at universities has come under such duress, not least in California, where affirmative action has been outlawed for access. to higher education now for, you know, almost two decades, a decade and a half. That said, so I think it's important to try to find ways to ensure that those populations that have had less access to higher education, in particular blacks and Latinos, find ways in which they have access generally to the best sort of education that, in this case, the state can offer. I want to make one other point in this regard that I think is very important. Even if it affirmative action comes up to the Supreme Court and is now, you know, more likely to be ruled unconstitutional, I think there's a way to address this that takes into account a wider range of considerations in student access, or in the kind of criteria by which or for which student or on which students are admitted to colleges, and not just take scores. Scores are just one indication among others, both of capability and of merit, right? I mean, it's one among others. There are other things that, people of diverse backgrounds bring into an educational setting. The capacity to make judgments, the capacity to think on their feet, the capacity to be able to negotiate social situations on the street or in jobs, the capacity to speak a variety of languages. One can go on and on and on in this kind of way. We are a very heterogeneous society, and we want all service-related conditions, whether it's in banks, whether it's in giving loans, whether it's in investment opportunities, whether it's in education itself, whether it's in nursing and healthcare and medical, higher levels of medical care, to be populated by as diverse a range of people as the people it's serving, not to be top-down in that sense. And if we take that seriously, then we ought to have as diverse a population attending the best colleges as we have the population in the state more largely.
Well, thank you very much. You know, David, we're talking to David Goldberg of the University of California at Irvine, and we've just touched upon a number of subjects that he's written about. We have about a minute left here. I didn't get to your latest book, The Racial State, which I meant to, and I have a number of questions, but maybe you could just say as a last note about what the book's about and why you wrote it, and for a minute, and then we'll say goodbye.
Right. Well, thank you. There is one later book called The Threat of Race, and it's linked very directly to the question about racelessness and neoliberalism. The Threat of Race, the subtitle is Racial Reflections on Racial Neoliberalism, so the way in which race plays out in a post-racial society. And the driving question there is not whether or not we're a post-racial society. I think the response is absolutely obvious, as many people have pointed out. We're not close to being there yet, notwithstanding President Obama's election. The question is what work in and around race the concept of the claim to post-racialism is doing. What does it cover up? What does it deflect? What does it do in terms of reversing charges of racism against populations who have suffered racism and so on and so forth? The racial state is really an argument about the way in which modern states become modern and have become modern since the 16th century, roughly, in and through racial categorization and classification. And the way in which claims to race morphed through the 19th century and into the 20th century to claims to racelessness, so to colorblindness, to non-racialism, to post-racialism, and so on and so forth. So it's tracing historically those transformations, right, from one commitment and category to another each of which in its own way covers up and hides from view the possibility of thinking more deeply about the pernicious effects of racism in a society like ours.
Well, time's up. Thank you very much, David. It's been very interesting. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. And
I appreciate it.
Again, thanks again, listeners, and we'll be back again next Thursday at 9 a.m. So good morning and talk to you later. Bye-bye.